from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, is it ever too late to learn to play a musical instrument? Psychology professor Gary Marcus thinks not, and he backs it up by having taken up guitar himself. In his book, Guitar Zero, Marcus explores the scientific, social, and psychological factors instrumental in learning to play the guitar at middle age. He'll join us for the hour next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the Forum program. Gary Marcus, an NYU professor of cognitive psychology, runs NYU's Center for Language and Music, and at 39, he took a sabbatical and made himself a guinea pig by taking up the guitar in order to answer the question of how well one can learn a musical instrument in the throes of middle age. The result is his book, Guitar Hero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. Gary Marcus has published in the New York Times, Wired, The Wall Street Journal, and Discover, and is editor of the Norton Psychology Reader, as well as the author of three earlier books on the origins and development of the mind and the brain. And he joins us for this Forum Hour in studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there's always this notion that many of us have, you can learn a language much easier if you're a kid. And presumably the same holds true for an instrument. But I guess the real lesson in your book is age is immaterial. You can learn an instrument anytime you want to, if you just do the right way.
I don't want to say it's immaterial, but it's overrated. So the old idea was that you had to learn something, say, by the time you were 3 years old or by the time you were 15 and started thinking about sex. You know, you were done after that. And the new data show that what was once called a critical period is a much softer concept than that. So it probably is easier to learn a lot of things when you're a kid, but not necessarily a lot easier. And it's not a matter of night and day. It's more like a gradual dimmer switch kind of thing.
Well, this gets us into this kind of fascinating realm of neuroscience. It's neuroplasticity, right? That you can actually change the structure of the brain.
Anytime you learn something, you change the structure of the brain. Music is kind of interesting because you have to change so much of the structure of the brain. There's so many different aspects of the brain that are involved in music. So you need neuroplasticity in your amygdala to deal with the emotional sides of music, in your frontal cortex to deal with the composition as a whole, your somatosensory cortex to deal with feeling the strings. So you need a lot of plasticity in a lot of different places for music. But anytime you learn something, if you're listening to this broadcasting, you encode some of the information, there's some kind of neuroplasticity going on.
Well, the concept also has a great deal to do with the realization that you can learn an instrument. I mean, how confident were you when you went into this? Because I know you were playing a video game that really sort of led up to this.
And, yeah, the title of the book, Guitar Zero, is actually a play on words in two ways. One is the video game Guitar Hero had something to do with it. And the other is I was really starting from ground zero, and that's kind of rounding up. And it was really like negative talent when I started. Like I tried to play recorder in fourth grade, and I couldn't play that classic song, Mary Had a Little Lamb, and I was so bad at it that the teacher suggested, truthfully but not helpfully, that my talents lay elsewhere.
You couldn't even keep time with a metronome. I mean, Daniel Levitin, who's been on the show, I think is a buddy of yours. What did he give you, some kind of diagnosis that you were, you had congenital arrhythmia? Or?
He and I remember the conversation slightly differently, but he gave me a few guitar lessons. This is before I started in earnest, and I went home, I did my homework, I came back, and my sense of time was so bad that by the end of the conversation, I was convinced that I probably had congenital arrhythmia. I don't know if he said it or I said it, but the next day I sent an email to a friend of his who's an expert on these things, and I was hoping to see the friend, and timing didn't work out. But so it came out of a conversation with him, the realization that there was a name for what I always knew, which is that terrible sense of time.
But see, here's the rub. I mean, I confess I tried to learn an instrument when I was younger. I studied the trumpet, and my trumpet teacher called me Dizzy, not because of Dizzy Gillespie, by the way. He just thought I didn't really have the ability to play the trumpet that well or to master an instrument. I thought he was probably right. But if I could buoy up my confidence now, and your book is inspiring in this way, maybe I could take up an instrument. The problem is that adults get too anxious about learning an instrument too quickly, generally, don't they?
Absolutely. I think the biggest obstacle for an adult who's trying to learn an instrument is ambition and sort of self-censorship. So adults already know the music they're trying to play. They're like, I want to play Stairway to Heaven and I want to be able to do it in a week, and it's never going to happen. Kids are just like, well, let me see what I can do with the instrument. And they're not necessarily as ambitious. They understand that they can't do everything immediately. That's sort of part of being a child, is that, you know, things are challenging. You put some work into it, maybe you get better. Adults are more sort of results oriented. They're not necessarily enjoying the process. And I think the trick to becoming a musician as an adult, not necessarily a professional musician, but just someone who can sort of participate in the party, is to recognize that you need to take things slowly, and that if you do, you can make progress, but you have to enjoy the ride rather than being fixated on the results.
So how important is innate talent?
Innate talent is pretty important if you want to be great. It's maybe optional if you merely want to be good. So there's this thing about 10,000 hours of practice and anyone can be an expert, and that's very much exaggerated. So how long it takes to learn something depends on what you're learning, and it also depends on how much innate talent you have, and that consists of genes. I don't think there are any genes in the human genome that are specifically for music, but there are genes for things like your dexterity, your sense of pitch, your sense of time, and those things contribute to talent. And if you want to be truly great at something, you need to both put in the hard work and be naturally gifted. But if you just want to have fun, which is what I've been doing, then you don't really need the talent. You put in the hours and you can still be reasonably good.
Well, you put in 6 hours a day, though. I mean, this is
beginning, but after that, it was an hour a day.
It's infectious, the sense of joy that you got out of this. Can congenital arrhythmia be cured, though? Can you learn rhythm?
I learned sense of rhythm. I'm not great. I don't want to say that, you know, I'll be headlining a band anytime
soon.
You're
not with Hendrix or Clapton.
I'm not with Hendrix or Clapton yet, but there was a profile of me in the New York Times a few weeks ago that ended with a true story, which is that just before Christmas, I went to a wedding, and I danced at the wedding, and I always enjoyed dancing, but I had no sense of time. And this time people actually complimented me on my dancing. And obviously
wow.
That's come from all the practice and music, which is with a metronome, a drum machine, and also an iPhone app that I wrote, which people can download, called Chatternome, which counts the beats out loud. So it'll go 1 and 2 and 3. And that helped to internalize.
That was at the World Science Festival, in fact.
Different app. I wrote two apps. One's called Chatternome, and the other one for the World Science Festival is called 3-in-1 Improviser. And that gives non-musicians a sense of what it's like to improvise.
Talking, if you just join us, with Gary Marcus, professor of psychology at New York University and director of the Center for Language and Music there. He also directs the Infant Language Learning Center, and his book is Guitar Zero. And there's a sense that we were talking about the brain before, and I know this is your bailiwick. A lot of brain scans seem to show that there are different connections with different instruments.
That's right. Learning different instruments demands different things. So, for example, in guitar, you have to spend a lot of your brain power on just remembering where the notes are as compared to on a piano. So everything's laid out in a very neatly organized fashion on the piano. But on a guitar, like, every string is different, and it's kind of complicated, especially for a beginner. And so that makes a different kind of memory demand. If you're playing violin, then you have to have a really fine sense of pitch because you don't have the frets that help mark off the notes that you do on a guitar.
You studied a lot of music theory. Did that help you with all this? Or, I mean, in addition to all your neurological and neuron...
The music theory definitely helped. So a lot of the music that I play is improvised, and it helps to understand something about the nature of music and how it works and so forth to do that. So I often compare myself to kids and how they're learning and so forth. And there's some things the kids can do better, like they have just faster fingers and they tend to have more persistence, so they pick up a pattern more quickly. But I have a bit better sense of how music works as a whole, both because I've been a listener for so much longer than they have and because I've studied some of the formal sides.
Talking about kids, talk a little bit, if you would, about the Day Jam summer camp experience that you had.
That was terrific. So after I'd been practicing about 9 months, I got in touch with this camp called Day Jams. That's a national camp. There was a particular satellite in Baltimore where I grew up. And I talked to the camp director and I asked if he could come. And he said, sure, you can come. And you can come watch if you want. But if you really want to get the flavor of it, you've got to play in a band. And then he said, and of course, you'll want to play bass because there's never enough bass players. And so at that point, I dropped the guitar and picked up bass for the first time. And then I was like all nervous, would the kids pick me, and I wanted to actually be in a band. And then I was able to get in a band, and this was on a Monday. And by Friday, the deal was that you would be playing on stage a song that you had written with your band, not a cover. And the kids all brought their parents, and I brought my parents along. My wife came down from New York. And so it was both anxious and really fun. It was a lot of pressure, you know, to see, could I learn this and could I keep up with the kids? And it was incredibly fun to watch them. I bonded with them on the first day because we played Ultimate Frisbee and I had the height. So
the sense I get from your writing is that immersion can really work. I mean, there are a lot of people, for example, who think if they immerse themselves in a foreign language, let alone a musical instrument, there are too many blocks too much habitual that you can't break through. It's impregnable.
Yeah, I mean, without immersion, I think it's hard to learn anything that's really complex. I think immersion is the best way to learn a language. It's the best way to learn an instrument. And that comes from the nature of human memory, which is very much driven by the last thing that you heard. It's something that we call priming. So if the last thing you heard is a bunch of words about slow and Florida and stuff like that, then you might think of the elderly, and that might actually make you walk slower. There's a famous study that was done at NYU by somebody else. So the last thing that you hear has a big influence on what you're doing. And if you learn a whole bunch of things connected consecutively, then your brain can consolidate them. But if you spread them over a week or over a month, those same things are going to be harder to encode in a long-term way. So immersion is really valuable when you're trying to learn something complicated. A musical instrument is certainly that.
And it also has a lot to do with overcoming habit. I mean, I think it was Beckett who said habit is a great deadener. I mean, you really need to break away from, strategically break away from habit. Yeah?
That's right. I mean, one of the most important things in learning any skill is forming the right habits. And especially if you've already started with the wrong habits, you have to really put in a hard push to move against them.
We're talking again with Gary Marcus, not only a cognitive psychologist and an author, but also a juggler, a unicyclist, a photographer, and now a guitar player. Man, obviously, of many colors and versatility. There's you were talking before about the 10,000-hour rule. There's also this critical period theory. Talk about that, because that is something that you explored and really learned a good deal in contrast to.
Well, so the critical period theory is this idea that you've got to learn something when you're three. And one of the first reasons that we realized it wasn't true is that some adults were learning languages as natives. Not every adult can do it.
It was at that age, three, as opposed to four.
Three, it varies. Sometimes it's three, sometimes it's five. I mean, that should have been a sign right away. Nobody could actually agree on what the critical period was. And then they also started doing animal studies, because you really want to do carefully controlled studies where you take a young organism and an older organism, give them exactly the same training regime, and see which one does better. So one of the most famous studies that people used as evidence for critical periods was one where they kind of did a virtual reality experiment with an owl. So owls have to calibrate their eyes with their ears. They're nocturnal, but they get some they're sort of like bats, but they have better vision. And they have to calibrate their eyes with their ears. And there was this famous experiment where a Stanford researcher, Eric Knudsen, put a prism on the owl's eyes and did it with young owls and old eyes and distorted the world by 23 degrees. And the young owls got it right away, and the old owls didn't get it. And so people said, there's a critical period. But Knudsen himself later did another study where he taught the older owls incrementally, so 3 degrees of distortion the first week and 6 the next week and 9 and so forth. And then the older owls were able to do it. So by taking small bite-sized steps, the older owls could do the same thing the younger owls could. So for me, that was kind of the rallying cry for this whole project, writing the book and learning to play guitar was you know, maybe I could be like those older owls. If I took bite-sized steps, maybe I could get somewhere.
But I can hear people thinking I'm going to retire. I'm going to learn an instrument now. You know, I'll be inspired by Gary Marcus and everything. But then there's always this notion that as you get older, all your neurons start dying. I mean, new ones come about too. But, you know, that you're just slower somehow because you are.
You might be a little slower, but if you do it incrementally like I'm describing, you can still learn the same things. It may take you longer than if you were younger, and maybe you can't get quite as good. So, I mean, maybe it's not realistic that you're going to headline a band if you start it when you're 60. But then again, I got an email the other day from someone. She had given a copy of the book to her father. Her father was 76. He'd been playing for a couple of years, and they just started a band called The Three Grandfathers.
We're talking again with Gary Marcus. His book is Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. And you can join us. In fact, I'd like to hear some experiences, if you have them, with attempting to learn a language or attempting to learn a musical instrument at whatever age seems sort of above the middle age mark, when you're in, as I say, the throes of middle age, or maybe you know someone who encountered it, had difficulties, impediments, or maybe had great success. We'd like to hear from you, and you can join us now toll-free, 866-733-6786. If you have questions or comments, or you have sort of a brief and cogent story to relate to us, again, we welcome your phone calls. It's 866-733-6786 to join us. You can also join us by email. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and join us that way, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment, or also you can go to our Facebook page. You did some collaboration with Steven Pinker. He was a mentor of yours, yeah?
Yeah, my doctoral dissertation was with Steve Pinker on how children learn language.
There's also a lot – I couldn't help in reading your book thinking a lot of Oliver Sacks. I mean, this whole sense of how the brain works, and particularly with music, I mean, Sachs has written so much on this, and mm-hmm. there was even a couple of films made and so forth. But I was particularly reminded of that that film where that guy was only – he lost his memory, and he only would come back to his former self when he heard the songs. It was based on a Sachs essay from that era when he lost his memory after being in a coma for a number of years. I mean, the brain is still pretty mysterious to us.
The brain is very mysterious. I mean, the truth is we only have a dim understanding. We're sort of like – medicine was for the heart when people just first realized that the heart was a mechanical pump, but didn't really know a whole lot more than that. We still have only a sketchy understanding of the brain.
Especially where music in some ways is concerned. I mean, it's we know we love it. We know it captivates us. But for example, you raise a question, what does it have to do with evolution?
So I've actually argued that music is not a direct product of evolution. You should think of music more like something like reading. It's a skill that we can naturally learn that we very much love once we've got it. But it takes work. So it takes, you know, several years to learn to read. It takes many people several years to learn to sing in pitch. I'm not sure I've got it now as an adult. Music is something that we're naturally predisposed to like because it fits some of the aesthetics of our brain, but I don't think it's actually built in. I don't think it's actually directly the product of natural selection.
Well, in fact, you emphasize the bliss and the happiness that comes from learning. I mean, it's maybe the pleasure principle that's operating more than evolution.
Indeed, I think that's just right. I think the reason that we like music, or one of the reasons I should say that we like music, is because it mixes two things that seem almost contradictory, which are our love of familiarity and our love of novelty. So we love a steady drum beat because our brain sort of gets a kick of dopamine every time we make a correct prediction. We're like, ah, I got that. I get it. But eventually that tires out. And we like novelty a lot too. Music gives us both. It gives us novelty and familiarity. So you take a steady drum beat, but you change the lyrics every verse or something like that. And then you get both at once. So one of the reasons music is so potent is it taps into this primal system that doesn't have anything to do with music in particular, but that gives us rewards for having both novelty and familiarity. And because music is extended over time and allows you to have multiple layers, it allows you to get both at once. That's part of what makes it so potent.
It's also the sense of mastery that brings pleasure, too. I mean,
if you're talking about being a performer, that's definitely true.
Even before performing, just the idea of, I mean, you talk about having rhythm now. I mean, mm-hmm. mastering the sense of rhythm can give you an extraordinary amount of pleasure.
Absolutely.
And feeling of success. Let's find out what our listeners have to say. We go first to Gary in Placerville. Hi, Gary.
Oh, hi, Michael. Hey, thanks for having me on the show. I listen a lot and I really enjoy it. I'm 62 now, and I got off a school board and found I needed a creative outlet and started playing bass guitar. And, man, I've just had a great time and revived a couple old buddies of mine who were musicians. And now I'm in two groups and kind of perform off and on in the Placerville area. And we just have a great time. And from that experience, I started playing the piano. And my piano teacher says adults are the hardest to teach. And some of what's being talked about today may be some of the reason, but it's very, very rewarding, and I just call it adult recess, and I want to encourage everyone to just try whatever they've got on their minds, especially music. I read Oliver Sacks's book about the mind and music, and it's a very, very unique thing, and thank you very much for having this show and letting me speak to this.
Well, thank you for your contribution, and congratulations on your playing in two bands, no less.
I'm actually collecting stories like yours on my website, garymarcus.com, under stories. You can send me an email message that way and tell me a little bit more about the bands you're in and things like that, and I'll post it on my website.
Very good. Well, I no doubt hear some of those stories in the course of this hour. Let's go to David next. David, hi.
Hi there. I was wondering, I'm sure you speak to this in your book, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how much instruction you got over the course of learning, and if you can speak to the quality of instruction and how I imagine that impacts how well a person learns.
Indeed. There's
I
a
can
whole...
take my response off the air.
Okay. Thank you for the call.
There's a whole chapter in the book about teachers. The first thing that I should admit is that for the first 6 months, I didn't go to a teacher. I was so traumatized by the recorder teacher who told me I had no business being in a music class that I just practiced by myself and didn't want to go to a teacher. But eventually I got hooked up with a lot of great teachers, both for myself, and I also sat in on Suzuki classes with six-year-olds. So I talk a lot about different kinds of teachers and what they bring to the table. And I think there are a lot of different things that can make a teacher great. One is knowing all the songs and all the chords and things like that. But I don't think that's really what you should be looking for. So a lot of people like find the guy who once played with the Pretenders or something like that, and you're the person who sat in on a session with some famous band. I don't think that's the right way of finding a teacher. I think the right way to find a teacher is to find someone who's a good diagnostician who can communicate in terms that you understand. So something like a good car mechanic can say, these are the things you're not quite getting, and this is how you can fix those kinds of things.
It's also the difference between, I think... Sal Bellow once said, I'm a bird, I'm not an ornithologist. And, you know, the idea of having music taught to you by someone who is a bird, for example, I mean, who plays and is a performer, isn't necessarily equate with what it takes to be a good teacher, or let alone, you know,
that's right,
ornithologist.
Right now, I'm blessed with a really wonderful teacher, Terry Roach of the trio The Roaches. And she's a great teacher in part because after she had a very successful career as a musician, she went as a guitarist and a vocalist, she went back and learned jazz piano at like the age of 35 or something like that. So she has a real sense of what it is to learn something as an adult, and as well as knowing all the stuff that she knows about music theory. And that and she also has this great curiosity about, well, where are my students getting stuck? And I think that's what you want, is someone who really cares about where the students get stuck, not just what you need to know, but, you know, what are the problems that people face? And that relates to the Sal Bellow quote that you just gave. You know, if you're a bird versus an ornithologist, you're going to get stuck in different places, and you want a teacher who's sensitive to that.
Well, I know there are listeners out there probably wondering, since you've worked so much with kids, what you think of the Suzuki method, just generally.
I think in some ways it's fantastic, and there are some things that I think it might leave to be desired. So what I think is fantastic about it is the emphasis on perfect technique, because one of the hardest things, we were talking about this a little bit a moment ago, is overcoming bad habits. So if you start with perfect technique, which is what really happens in Suzuki, that's a really beautiful thing. In fact, when I had the opening night for my book, I had a six-year-old who I'd been watching for 2 years and who was now 8 years old. She had practiced every day for 2 years, and she closed the show, and she was fantastic, and she was a Suzuki student. The one thing that I don't love about Suzuki is there's not as much emphasis as I would like typically in improvisation. And like conservatories, I think sometimes people come away knowing how to play the classic pieces but not having a sense that they can make their own music. And for me, the sense that I can make my own music is actually the most rewarding part.
Do you have a recommendation? I know there are a lot of people out there who are thinking, boy, I'd like to take up the guitar, but what type of guitar? And should it be a six string, or should it be an electric guitar, or, you know, what should it be?
I think that's a matter of personal choice. What I would say is that you have to love your instrument to get good at it. So nobody's going to get good at an instrument in 20 minutes. You're going to have to spend a lot of time, and so you have to enjoy the instrument that you play. One of the reasons I picked guitar rather than piano was I didn't have a real piano. I just had a keyboard, and I didn't have that same visceral feeling. I mean, there's a kind of love about it. You've got to fall in love with your instrument if you're going to put in the time. And so, you know, play different instruments. Some people like electric guitars because they have lighter strings and they just feel more comfortable, and I can see an argument for that. But ultimately, it's about, you know, how do you like the sounds?
Talking again with Gary Marcus, his book is Guitar Zero, and here's a listener who writes, I'm a mom of two teenagers, and I recently started taking piano lessons. It has been a blast, but what has startled me is how anxious I get about my lesson. Did I practice enough? Will my teacher think I worked hard enough? Will this be a good lesson? It makes me so empathetic to kids when I think about how many lessons they go to each week and how they must deal with the stress in an ongoing way at lessons and school. Well, that has been the biggest revelation for me and made me much more sympathetic to them. I now think twice before I say to my kids, did you practice enough? Would I want them saying that to me? No.
It's a great letter.
Yes. Well, we'll go to more of your emails and find out what many of you have to say in your phone calls when we come back from a break, which we're going to go to here. Here's Mark, though, who writes, some instruments, such as violin, require exceedingly fine motor control in order to play in tune. Does Dr. Marcus believe that an adult beginner, say 35 years old, can become a world-class violinist if he or she has a great talent and puts in the work? Or are there indeed immovable barriers to greatness after a certain age?
I mean, I think that being a world-class violinist is perhaps too great an aspiration. But can you enjoy the violin? Absolutely.
A good diplomatic answer. Thank you, Gary. And we'll come back and find out what more of you have to ask and say. Hear some of your stories about perhaps learning an instrument or a language at a later stage of your life. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Is it ever too late to play a musical instrument? Well, psychology professor Gary Marcus thinks not, and backs it up by having taken up guitar lessons himself. And in his book, Guitar Zero, he explores the scientific, social, and psychological factors instrumental in playing the instrument of a guitar. He's professor of psychology and director of the NYU Center for Language and Music, and also directs the Infant Language Learning Center at New York University. His book is Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. And you are certainly welcome to join the program. You can do so at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. Here's Andy, who says, at the age of 65, I still work in high-tech, write, and am an active photographer, but this year I began taking guitar lessons to challenge my mind in new ways. After 2 months, my calluses are forming, and I'm beginning to be able to move my fingers from chord to chord. Clapton, probably not, but it's fun. I also played recorder in the fourth grade. And here's a listener.
Kindred spirit.
Who says, there are a lot of kindred spirits out there, I think, for you. Erlinda writes, I'm 63. About 7 years ago, my husband gave me a ukulele for Christmas because he knew I was interested in all things Hawaiian. I hadn't played any instrument for decades. It's been one of the joys of my life. It challenges my brain to learn the chords and picking and to learn and understand the Hawaiian language. I love the camaraderie with the ukulele community, too, and I made new friends. All those benefits. Let's go to more of your calls, and we go to John. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering just about neuro-linguistic programming or neuro-association. You know, I was listening to stuff about some of the Tony Robbins tapes, and where he talks about relearning anything, whether it's a musical instrument, how to sing, how to do something, a behavioral modification, losing weight, stop smoking, or changing your job, changing your relationship.
I don't know exactly what neuro-linguistic programming is. I've heard the term, but I haven't seen a lot of research in the areas that I work on it, so I can't really speak to it directly. But I would say that any of the things that you mentioned, you are rewiring the brain in some way.
There's a lot of emphasis put on all that neuro-linguistic programming can do in terms of behavior, and I think probably there's been a tendency to look at it as kind of magic bullets, which it doesn't really offer. I mean, I'm sure it's had some successes and some notable successes. I know it has because we've done programs on it, but that's been inflated. Thanks for the call, John, and we go to more of your calls. Let's go to Rick. Rick, you're on.
Yes, hello. I'm interested to know how long the professor has been, how old was he when he started juggling? Because that seems like a congenital arrhythmia it seems like juggling would require some sense of timing and rhythm.
There's a funny story about that that actually combines the ukulele question a minute ago, which you would not have expected. But my first live singing performance was singing with a little help with your friends, with a little help from my friends, with a little help from some friends. And it was a struggle. I got through it. And then afterwards, I was the MC at this event, and all the Beatles songs were being played on ukulele by a friend of mine. And I was an MC, and then the next song was Magical Mystery Tour. And the person who was singing that one asked if anyone could, you know, act like a clown or whatever. And I said, well, I can juggle. He said, bring your stuff. And I juggled during the song. And then afterwards, my friends who had saw me struggle with the shuffle rhythm of With a Little Help from My Friends said, oh, my God, you played perfect you juggled in perfect triplet time the whole time through the song. And I think that's because there's an external constraint when you're juggling. You just can't do it except by doing it in triplets. But it's harder to internalize that sense of rhythm when there isn't that physical constraint forcing you to do it. But it's really interesting that people can do things in, say, a conscious way or do things in an unconscious way that they can't do in a conscious way.
Yeah, but you talk about it as a struggle to juggle, and there was a struggle.
Learning to juggle three balls was not that hard. I can actually juggle five, and that took a lot of practice. That took an hour a day for, I think, a full summer, and I never got great at it, but I can do it a little bit.
You have another project?
Well, I've been doing a lot of unicycling lately in the snow. I got a unicycle with big fat tires, so that's been my most recent project.
And we thank Rick for the call, and on we go to more of your calls. Kathleen joining us. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. I'm in my late 60s, and I am about to go to Argentina, and so I've started to study Spanish. And I find it really surprising at times that when I'm trying to think of a word in Spanish, what comes up is the word in French, as if there was like a link to another brain path. So I'm thinking about, is it the same brain path as before? Will I lose some of my French as I get Spanish? And then the second question is, I found that I have a certain way of learning, and that means I look for a certain kind of teacher. Do you also see a pattern of learning styles as in other things?
We'll take your second question first. There are certainly different learning styles, and it's really important to find a teacher that meshes with your learning styles. Going back to the first question, it's not at all unusual for people.
It happens to me all the time. Because I have a few languages, I'll think in one language and the words will fire off in the other language.
And this has to do with the organization of the brain's memory system. So in a computer, you could have separate data banks and you could just say, let's go to the French data bank, let's go to the Italian data bank. So Google Translate never gets confused between the languages that it's translating into. But the way our memories work, and I talked about this a lot in my last book, Kluge, The Haphazard Evolution of the Human Mind, the way our memories work is sort of like a box full of old photographs or something like that, a shoebox full of photographs. We just don't know exactly where things are. And so we use cues or reminders, and sometimes those cues are vague. And so basically your brain is responding to, give me a foreign word in that means cat or something. And sometimes you come up with the Italian one, and sometimes you come up with a Spanish one. If we had more precise memories, that wouldn't happen. But until we find some brain circuit to give us sort of Google memory on a chip, we're going to keep making those kinds of mistakes.
And Kathleen, where are you going in Argentina?
I'm first starting out at Mar del Plata and then probably going to either Mendoza. I don't have a lot of days. I have 10 days there. I'll go to Mar del Plata, then Mendoza and Buenos Aires.
Well, have a wonderful trip. And should there be time, I was just telling a friend yesterday, I think one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen is in Bariloche, which is across from Patagonia.
Ah.
And thank you for the call. made me think about, actually, mnemonics. They're very useful. I mean, particularly if you can...
Mnemonics.
Yeah. I mean, if you can tell yourself that there's something you can associate with a particular word or with a particular act that you're going to do, it works.
Yeah. Our brains are set up so that mnemonics are kind of like Band-Aids to work around the fact that we don't have proper databases like computers do. So mnemonics are ways of using different cues to remind other sets of cues, and they work very well. And the most famous one is the method of the loci, where you associate everything with a particular room in some house, that giant hall that everybody knows. But there are lots of them. They're Tom Lehrer's songs to help you remember chemistry and things like that.
And we go to more of your calls. And let's go to Kim. Join us.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi. So my husband at age 47 got a rare congenital disease called pseudoxanthoma elasticum. It's where basically he has no central vision at all. It's like severe macular degeneration. About 5 years after that, he picked up the bass guitar. And he's been working at it since then. And he's pretty good. But I thought he needed help, so I was looking around for a teacher. And it went great until I told him, you know, he's visually disabled. And then they kind of got freaked out. So do you have any, first of all, is it, what happens in the brain when not only do you have to overcome age, but you have some sort of disability? He has a RIC. He's in love with it. And he's very good. He really is. But I think he needs some guidance. Can you offer anything?
I'm going to recommend a friend, actually, who has worked with blind musicians before and would be happy to help, and does Skype lessons, which can be audio. They don't have to be visual. Or my friend can watch your husband. His name is Tobias Hurwitz, and you can find him on the resources page of GaryMarcus.com. I have a link to him. There are probably lots of other people that could help, too. But he's one of the people that I know who's happy to work with people who are blind. Your husband's not actually blind, but you know, visually impaired.
Right.
And, of course, there's a long tradition of blind musicians, visually impaired musicians, probably most famously keyboard players like Stevie Wonder or something like that, but Ray Charles. But there are tons of guitar players, too, like Reverend Gary Davis is blind.
Well, good luck to your husband, and thank you for the call, Kim. And again, GaryMarcus.com is also the place to go if you have stories that you want, I suppose in his next book or the – what are you putting together here, Gary?
I have a website that's just kind of collecting them as inspiration, but some of them might wind up in the next book, actually.
Well, if you're giving inspiration, let's give some practical advice, because you do give it in the book. Small steps, scale down expectations. I mean, again, I think that's been emphasized by you before in this course of conversation. But also, you talk about practicing strategically and particularly targeting...
targeting your weaknesses.
Your weaker skills, yeah. Talk about why that works in terms of the brain.
Well, if you spend 10,000 hours practicing the same riffs over and over again or the same three songs, you're not really going to become a broad musician. You get really good at those narrow things, but it's not an efficient use of your time. There are many other things to learn. So in my case, my rhythm was so poor that I couldn't really do a lot of other things until I took care of that first. And not that I've completely taken care of it. I'm not good enough to play in a jazz band. But I've gotten it to a point where it's okay. So targeting your weaknesses is going to make you a more balanced musician. Or we've been talking about music, but you could target your weaknesses if you're learning a foreign language. Maybe you need to work on the declensions. We often work on the things that make us happiest, which are often the things that we're best at. But you really need to balance that with some attention to the things that you're weaker at. And that's one of the reasons to have a teacher, is a teacher can pick out things you don't even realize you're doing wrong, like problems with your posture and things like that.
And what about other things? Like, you know, you think about people, for example, who say they have no mechanical skill. You know, they just, when it comes to plumbing or electrical things or under the car hood, they just are hopeless.
I mean, any of these things can be learned if you're willing to apply yourself and if you're willing to be patient. I think the biggest problem that people have in learning a lot of those kinds of skills is they're just scared and they want to understand
all in a day. Or uninterested
maybe
too. Yeah.
Or uninterested. I mean, you're not going to be able to learn something if you're not interested. I mean, you can't get good at something unless you put in time, and you can't put in time unless you enjoy it or really genuinely want to do it.
And we go to more calls, and let's go next to Menlo Park. Laura, join us. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I was listening to your program as I was driving home from my piano lesson, and it really resonated with me. I'm a 54-year-old woman, and I started lessons as an adult when I was 30. And after about 10 years, started taking over my own teacher's overflow, and then at age 50, went back to get my master's in piano and also undergrad degrees, because I never had any formal music college training. And so I've been doing that for 4 years, and I'm probably the happiest person I know. It's a lot different, though, for me. I'm in class with 19 and 20-year-olds who are prodigies and who are dynamic piano players that I'll never ever be able to approach.
But yeah, but you're feeling younger every time you go, aren't you?
Absolutely.
You're probably happier than they are.
Yeah.
I don't have the expectation of going through serious competitions and things like that, but I know that I get smarter every day.
Well, it sounds like you're having a lot of fun, and thank you for letting us know about that. Here's a listener who says, I can learn new skills at middle age, be it with a little more work. The problem I have is I seem to forget these new skills faster than when I was younger. I have to keep on reviewing what I have learned or else it vanishes. When I was younger, I didn't have this problem.
I mean, that might be true. I mean, memory does get weaker with age, and refreshing is always a good thing for everyone. So, I mean, there might be some truth to that. You might also be more self-critical. So I think people reach a certain age and they're just more aware of the things they forgot. So when they're 20 and they forget something, they don't even notice it. And when they're 50, you're like, oh, is this a senior moment?
I'm always amazed at what my listeners remember. Here's one, a listener named Lisa, who writes, I would like to criticize the guest's argument that being a great musician is part innate talent genetics. Forum program with David Schenk in 2010 dispels the idea of talent as innate or DNA as a blueprint. This guest is discussing a continuing ability to learn later in life and plasticity, and I would argue, based on my memory of Schenk's research, that even innate talent is developmental and depends on process and behavior.
Well, we can take that piece by piece. An earlier book of mine was called The Birth of the Mind. That was about the interaction between genes and environment. And pretty much everything that goes on is an interaction between the two. But that doesn't mean the genes disappear. So when you learn something, your genes actually make a difference for how well you can learn it. Human beings learn things, many things, a lot better than other species because we have better genes for learning things. And there are genes that help learning different kinds of things. So association is a different kind of thing than learning language.
Do you know Schenk's work, though?
I know that kind of argument. I don't think I know that particular argument. But if you go back and you look, for example, at the most famous data in this field, which is Anders Ericsson's work on people acquiring musical expertise, what you'll see is a strong correlation between how many hours people practiced and how good they are. But it's not a perfect correlation. So
that's the 10,000-hour rule.
This is where the 10,000-hour idea came from. But if you look carefully at the data, you go back to the original data, you'll see that there are some people that practice for 20 years that aren't as good as other people that practice for 10 years. And that's about genes. That's about some people having a natural aptitude for learning things as opposed to other people not. So it really does need both. And that's because the brain is built in part by genes. You can't get rid of the genetic part. I wish you could. I think the Malcolm Gladwell message that anybody can do anything in 10,000 hours is a really uplifting message. But more realistic one is anybody can do anything reasonably well with 10,000 hours. But if you really want to talk about absolute top performance, you probably need both, just like the tallest plant is going to need the best genes and the best water and sunlight.
Well, when you think about the continuum that sort of at the top is genius, you realize there are musical geniuses, just like there are geniuses in all fields, as opposed to the rest of us who are very ordinary or in some cases inferior, or maybe ordinary and extraordinary in one area, but, you know, inferior in another.
Absolutely. There are geniuses. Those geniuses all worked hard. I mean, it's very rare that you find a genius that didn't. The only kind of thing, the music that comes to mind, is the Ramones were kind of musical geniuses. They found a kind of music that nobody else had, and they did it without much practice and just kind of intuitively. But almost everybody else that I can think of put in a ton of practice, but they often come from musical families. You can look at the lineages, or you can look at genetic studies of musical aptitude, and you will see that if your twin has a lot of musical aptitude, you're more likely to than if your twin doesn't. So there's a genetic factor that's not erasable.
Here's Ellie, who says, 2 years ago in my late 50s, I took up the harp. I had played flute throughout my schooling decades ago, so knew how to read music, etc. But the most challenging thing for me about learning the harp was getting what my harp teacher calls a second channel developed. Playing the flute means playing one note at a time with both hands operating together in a single channel, whereas playing the harp means more than one note at a time with each hand working independently, two channels. My teacher is currently learning the organ, adding third channel, feet, so she is very empathetic about what I'm going through. I am finding this journey rewarding, sometimes frustrating, and I hope it also is keeping the little gray cells vibrant too.
I mean, that's terrific. You can think of drummers have it even harder. They have to have four channels going, two different feet and two different hands. So that notion, it's called independence, having your hands do different things at different times. It's something that doesn't come naturally to the brain. I think because we have sort of one master clock that has to do double duty or triple duty or quadruple duty. A computer would assign a different clock to each of these things, perhaps. But we have one clock. It works over time, and it's hard. So anybody can see this at home by just trying to have their hands tap, say, one hand taps four times every time the other one taps three or something like that. That's called a polyrhythm. And it's hard to do. And the faster you do it, the more likely you are to lose it. It's not something that comes natural to the brain.
Well, we have a number of channels here, too, as you've gleaned probably. We have emails. We have web comments. We have also Facebook questions and comments. And we have our callers. And let's go to another one. Brian, hi. You're on the air.
Thank you, Michael. Great show. Don't have anything profound to add, but just to say that I really would encourage anyone to pick up the instrument, even late in life. I picked it up in late 40s, and I'm in my mid-50s, and there's no substitution for practice. But you haven't really talked about some of the resources that are available for independent learning online with a, you know, TrueFire or YouTube instruction.
That's right. There are a ton of resources out there. Some of them are actually on this webpage called Resources on my site. But there's lots of YouTube videos. We live really in the golden age of learning anything, whether you're talking about guitar or foreign language or what have you, because there is so much information. A lot of it's free. I don't think it's a substitute for having a teacher, because a teacher can notice the bad habits you're forming that you might not. But there's fantastic resources available. Just like 20 years ago, a lot of the musicians I've interviewed were like, well, we had to learn it from the records. Nobody explained anything to us. So now there are fabulous resources. But don't get so dependent on those that you forget about the teachers, because the teachers still, at least the good teachers, still have a lot to offer.
And thank you, Brian, for the call. Gary Marcus with us in studio, author of Guitar Zero, The New Musicians and the Science of Learning. And let's bring Scott aboard here. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Calling from San Francisco. My comment was more related to the juggling. I started training for circus performing at age 35. I had no idea what...
You ran away and joined the circus at age 35?
Yeah, well, that was never my intention, but after I had started training for a couple of, after I'd been training for a couple of years, I suddenly realized that I was advancing quicker than the people that I was training with that were 23, 25, or, you know, even 18. Suddenly, I was asked to audition for Cirque du Soleil at the age of 37.
Wow.
And I'd never in my wildest dreams imagined that somebody, you know, I was potentially going to be this 40-year-old traveling circus performer for, you know, one of the most elite circuses in the world.
You weren't hanging from wires in the Oscars last night by any chance, were you?
No, unfortunately, injury. I succumbed to too many injuries and wasn't able to continue. It's a very sad short story is that during the audition, actually warming up for the audition for Cirque du Soleil, I broke my ankle on a trampoline.
Oh, sorry.
So I was never able to actually pursue that. But I thought it was really interesting that being almost 40 years old and being asked to, I was actually asked. It wasn't something I was pursuing.
It is really interesting and again, inspiring. Thank you for the call. I want to go to another caller on here from Sequim, Washington. Where is that, Robin, that you're calling from?
Squim, Washington.
Oh, Squim.
That's okay. It's out on the Olympic Peninsula, not too far from Forks of Twilight fame, but that usually gives people an idea.
You listening to us online?
I'm actually, yes, I was.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
glad to have you.
Yeah, thank you. So I know you've been talking about music and being able to play and what, you know, if it's ever too late to start playing music. And I teach a really cool method called Simply Music. It's a playing-based piano approach. And I have students anywhere from the age of 6 to 92 who've started to take piano with me. And we learn through, it's playing-based, so we delay the reading for about the first year, and we just immerse students in learning to play by actually playing. And they play pop and blues and jazz and accompaniment and arrangements, and they compose and they improvise from the very beginning. They're learning through shapes and patterns and sentences, so it's very multisensory. So no matter what a person's strength is in terms of their learning, whether it's oral or visual or kinesthetic, we address all of those different modes of learning. So it's a really awesome way to get people onto the piano, playing their own music, playing other people's music, playing with groups, playing in bands. So I've had students start as old as 92.
That's terrific. Write to my stories thing and tell me about some of the older learners you've had. I'd love to hear more.
Yeah, I'd love to tell you. It's really a great thing when somebody comes after having, you know, tried and failed as a child and maybe tried again, and then they come in and they sit down and they just smile. They're just so excited that they're playing with, you know.
I left out a lot of the failures that I had early on. Like, there was something called the miracle piano that you could hook up to your Macintosh. This was when I was in graduate school, and I got through like 5 lessons and then couldn't do the rhythm part once again. So there were no miracles there. So I had many trying and failing. And that's probably part of why I enjoy it so much now, is that it just seemed impossible to me, and now I'm doing the impossible. It feels great.
Oh, Robin, thank you for your call. In fact, apropos of Robin's remarks, here's Anne, who says, great show. Quick question. What about when you start something as a child and pick it up again much later? How does that differ from what you start something new as an adult? I'm thinking of Etta Baker, my guitar hero, who played when she was young but stopped because of life, raising a family, etc., then picked it up again in her 70s or 80s. She had a new career as a performing artist in her late 80s, and she was brilliant. Is there a difference? I mean, is it worthwhile to start something while one is young with the thought of picking it up again later?
Well, there's definitely something called savings in cognitive psychology, which is this idea that if you learn something once, it makes it easier to learn it later. So you're definitely at an advantage if you started before. Even if you don't remember it, there's going to be at least a little help the second time around. I didn't know the Etta Baker story. I'm really glad that you brought it to my light.
But I'm also thinking about the fact that, you know, they say when you learn to ride a bicycle, you know, you can pick it up again many, many years later without having been on a bicycle all those decades or whatever it might be.
Yeah, a bicycle, to be honest, is easier than a guitar. So, I mean, if you put the guitar down for 40 years and you come back to it, you'll remember some things. It'll probably help you with rhythm, but it won't necessarily help you to remember your scales, for example.
Here's John, who says, considering the known neuroplasticity of the brain, have there been observations made of physical and functional changes in the brain of older individuals learning a musical instrument? If so, what kinds of changes?
The older adults have historically been understudied. I think I might finally have access to the right population of subjects. So the big problem is that, at least we thought, that most older adults just didn't have the time to really put in to really do those brain studies. So you want to look at people who have studied for or who are willing to come into the lab. And then from that point on, from ground zero, practice for 2 or 3 years and see what kind of changes there are. But I'm getting enough interest now that maybe we can actually find subjects that are sufficiently committed to do that.
And again, our guest is Gary Marcus, his book, Guitar Zero. And our next caller who's joining us is Scott. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thank you so much for squeezing me in. I have a complicated set of issues, so I will be very brief if I can. 43-year-old male, history of Hodgkin's lymphoma since I graduated Yale in 91. Had a bone marrow transplant, but okay now for many years. And I cannot replace or have not been able to replace the endorphin high, if you will, from playing syncopation on the drums when I was a kid. And I've had this hunger for several decades to take up classical guitar, but because of the long-term effects or late-term effects of the chemotherapy agents. I have bilateral neuropathy in my fingers, but I could still be athletic. It's just a little tough. And I also have a decreased executive function, as you may tell by some my descriptions here. So I'm looking for any suggestions to reignite that flame, taking that first step. Sometimes it's the hardest.
Maybe you want to take up percussion rather than something that requires that level of fine motor coordination. You can get that musical high from the syncopation that you described by playing an instrument that might not require so much fine motor coordination. The other thing is, enjoy the journey. So you might not be able to play as well as you were when you're younger, but try to enjoy the progress that you make.
And good luck, Scott. I hope you do progress. Here's Joe who says, if one instrument doesn't click, perhaps I should try another. I'm 40. Bass has frustrated me. I want to try the saxophone, but I fear dilettantism.
I mean, you have to pick an instrument and stick with it.
That's the bottom line. Here's Fran who says, I'm a former language professor who notes that kids are better at language because they are less afraid of trying and don't worry about making a mistake. Plus, their facial and mouth muscles are a lot more plastic and they have less difficulty making new sounds. As a beginning golfer, I once played with a 7-year-old who beat the pants off me simply because he wasn't afraid to swing or make a mistake.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. An adult's biggest problem is their fear of making mistakes.
Time maybe for one quick call, and that's you, Carol, please, quickly if you could.
Hi. Yes, I started the cello at the age of 53 with no musical background, and it's just been the most remarkably challenging and gratifying experience I've ever done. And so I just wanted to acknowledge your book, and the key thing that happened for me was just finding the right teacher. I must have gone through about 8 teachers, and that process of saying, no, this isn't the right teacher, and saving face on that, not wanting to offend the other person or not wanting to feel uncomfortable for whatever personal reasons there might be, is such an important part of the process, is to have courage around saying no if you realize that's not the right teacher.
I absolutely agree with you.
And I agree, too. And thank you, Carol, for that. A good way to wrap up. I just want to remind people, if you want to meet Gary Marcus, he'll be at the Booksmith and the Hate in San Francisco this evening at 7:30. You can also go to his website, GaryMarcus.com, and tell your stories there. You can go to our website and continue this discussion, kqed.org/forum. The book again, Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.